Blog Talk Radio.
Internet world, welcome to the Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble, and I hope that so far you've had a good week. It's Thursday already, and tomorrow, Friday, we'll be here, and for most of us, it's the beginning of a nice, relaxing weekend free from the curse of work. So glad you had an opportunity to join me this morning on the Cross in the Desert. Well, the subtitle for this program, very important, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran. And some of my Iranian listeners know how much I've invested in these two words, hope and freedom. Since Monday, I've been focusing in on the election, on Hillary Clinton, and on the pro-choice agenda that she has. I've titled this program, The Silent Holocaust, Hillary Clinton's War Against the Unborn. And my guests on Monday were two outstanding guests, Cindy Martin Morgan and Rick Morgan, and we talked at length about the sanctity of human life. We also talked about Hillary Clinton and the importance of this upcoming election. But I want to get back now to what I started out to share with you. Those two words, hope and freedom. For those that adhere to pro-choice, choice and freedom is sacred. It's my body. It's my choice. And so this program is all about speaking hope and freedom in the area of choice. And so many of my Iranian friends would conclude that certainly I have nothing against people that are pro-choice. Well, we're going to dig into this issue in quite a bit of depth today. I felt the need to explore this topic a little bit more since Monday because it's so important. I mean, after all, my program is all about choice and freedom. But let me ask you a question. As we explore this issue in depth, and we're not just driving through the takeout place and going home. We're going at this issue in some depth. God has given us choices. The Bible is full of choices. Choose you this day whom you shall serve. Make choices, the Bible says, but what about the content of our choice? No one's denying that we have a right or an opportunity to choose, but do we have a right to kill an innocent person? And most of us would agree that the protection of human life is very, very important. Human life is very, very valuable. And so, again, I'm not against choice, but what kind of choice are you making? And we're going to explore that in depth today on the Cross in the Desert. This election is absolutely one of the most important elections in a very long time. It's about protection, either having closed borders and or open borders, either bringing in more refugees. What about protection? What about human rights? And what about life? This election hinges on the election in the Supreme Court of justices. And if Hillary Clinton becomes president, those Supreme Court justices will engage in a liberal agenda and more of our freedoms will be eroded. And in fact, if Hillary Clinton becomes president, our borders will remain open. Thousands of Syrian refugees will be admitted in who haven't really been properly vetted. Human life will be very, very vulnerable. But today I'm talking about human life from just a different perspective, but nonetheless very important. Hillary Clinton has a very extreme liberal approach to the whole issue of the unborn. That's why I've called this program Hillary Clinton's War Against the Unborn. And here again is that word choice. Well, Randy, aren't you infringing on my choice? Aren't you shoving your morality down my throat? And what about your program speaking hope and freedom to Iran? How can that be hope and freedom if you're telling me how to choose? Well, I want you to listen very carefully to this program today. We're going to explore this issue. First and foremost, I want you to hear once and for all Hillary Clinton's position on the pro-choice movement and why I've entitled this program Her War Against the Unborn. I want you to hear for the next 3 or 4 minutes Hillary Clinton explaining exactly what she believes guarding the unborn. Let's listen.
Give me your straightforward position on the issue of abortion.
My position is in line with Roe v. Wade, that women have a constitutional right to make these most intimate and personal and difficult decisions based on their conscience, their faith, their family, their doctor, and that it is something that really goes to the core of privacy. Mm-hmm. And I want to maintain that constitutional protection under Roe v. Wade. As you know, there is room for reasonable kinds of restrictions after a certain point in time. I think the life, the health of the mother are clear, and those should be included even as one moves on in pregnancy.
When or if doesn't?
I've had the same position for many years.
When or if does an unborn child have constitutional rights?
Well, under our laws currently, that is not something that exists. The unborn person doesn't have constitutional rights. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't do everything we possibly can in the vast majority of instances to, you know, help a mother who is carrying a child and wants to make sure that child will be healthy, to have appropriate medical support. It doesn't mean that you don't do everything possible to try to fulfill your obligations, but it mm-hmm. does not include sacrificing the woman's right to make decisions. And I think that's an important distinction that under Roe v. Wade we've had enshrined under our Constitution.
You had said you're for some, there are room for some restrictions. So is it fair to say that women don't always have a full right to choose?
Well, under Roe v. Wade, that is the law. And as I said, I support the reasoning and the outcome in Roe v. Wade. So in the third trimester mm-hmm. of pregnancy, there is room for looking at the life and the health of the mother. Now, most people, not all Republicans, not all conservatives, even agree with the life of the mother, but most do. Where the distinction comes in is the health of the mother. And when you have candidates running for president who say that there should be no exceptions, not for rape, not for incest, not for health, mm-hmm. Then I think you've gotten pretty extreme. And my view has always been, this is a choice. It is not a mandate. You know, I have traveled all over the world. I have seen what happens when governments make these decisions, whether it was forced sterilization, forced abortion in China, yeah. or forced childbearing in communist Romania. So I don't think that we should be allowing the government to make decisions that really properly belong to the individual.
Hey, NBC News fans, thanks for checking out our YouTube channel. Subscribe by clicking on that button.
Well, there you have it. Very loud and clear. Once again, this agenda, in her own words, I was just awestruck at those words, that the unborn has no constitutional rights. Well, of course, that would be true if the unborn was simply a blob of tissue and not a human being. We will deal with that issue very soon. But it's extreme. This is Hillary Clinton in her most cherished moment when she can proclaim the so-called right to choose. I want you to hear once again her touting this view about the unborn without constitutional rights. This is her appearance recently on The View. Let's listen.
My view has always been this is a choice. It is not a mandate. The unborn person doesn't have constitutional rights. So in the third trimester mm-hmm. of pregnancy, there is room for looking at the life and the health of the mother.
Hillary went to visit the ladies on ABC's The View Monday, where she was asked when an unborn child has constitutional rights.
And Secretary, I want to ask you about some comments that you made over the weekend mm-hmm. on Meet the Press regarding abortion. You said, quote, the unborn person doesn't have constitutional rights. And my question is, at what point does someone have mm-hmm. constitutional rights? And are you saying that a child on its due date, just hours before delivery, still has no constitutional rights?
Under our law, that is the case, Paula. I support Roe v. Wade because I think it is an important statement about the importance of a woman making this most difficult decision with consultation by whom she chooses, her doctor, her faith, her family. And under the law, and under certainly that decision, that is the way we structure it.
When do you think an unborn child has constitutional rights? Share and comment below.
Now, we have listened once again to Hillary Clinton making it very clear that the unborn really isn't a human being. So therefore, since the unborn isn't a human being, it has no constitutional rights. And of course, it's because it's the law of the land. Now, just to further her agenda, about a year ago, she made a speech where she implied that religious, mainly the conservative right, those fundamentalists, you know, that their views on this whole issue and a woman's right are eventually going to have to change. Now, since that comment was made, all kinds of rhetoric has been espoused that, oh, she didn't mean that. You took her out of context. But I want you to hear what Hillary said about a year and a half ago. And she's pointing the finger, of course, at those religious fundamentalists like you and me. And she's warning us that our religious views must change on this issue. I want you to carefully listen to this.
But far too many women are still denied critical access to reproductive health care and safe childbirth. All the laws we've passed don't count for much if they're not enforced. Rights have to exist in practice, not just on paper. Laws have to be backed up with resources and political will, and deep-seated cultural codes, religious beliefs, and structural biases have to be changed. As I have said, and as I believe, the advancement of the full participation of women and girls in every aspect of their societies is the great unfinished business of the 21st century. And not just for women, but for everyone. And not just in faraway countries, but right here in the United States.
Well, of course, if the religious right, the conservatives, protest and disagree with the pro-life agenda, as we have for the last 43 years, we're being told, we're being warned that those views are going to have to change. Well, how are they going to change? Well, as you have heard in these last three examples, Hillary is very, very adamant about a woman's right to choose and the fact that the unborn have no constitutional rights. What I want to do right now is answer all of these assertions and ask some very important questions to you. Where do you stand on this issue? What do you believe about the status of the unborn? Is there an answer and reply to this kind of agenda and rhetoric? Well, yes, there is. And what I want to do for the next few minutes, I want you to hear from Stand to Reason, just a great Christian apologist. His name is Gregory Kukul, and he had a radio program, and this was from a few years ago. He was answering the question, is the unborn a person? I want you to carefully listen to this because it addresses everything that Hillary Clinton just said, and I believe it is a very logical, good response to this assertion. Let's listen.
Because most people impulsively will acknowledge the legitimacy of the first premise. It's wrong to kill an innocent human being without proper justification. They'll impulsively agree. They'll say, well, of course, we all agree with that. That's why you have laws against murder. And then they want to deny that the unborn is an example of an innocent human being. And when they find out that science won't allow them to do that with integrity, then they want to go back and try to undo the first premise. Well, let's think of that first one. Maybe it is okay to kill human beings as long as they don't have some other thing. What's that? They don't have personhood. And that's the some human beings are not persons argument that was, as it turns out, was at the heart of the Dred Scott decision and is at the heart of ethnic cleansing. You can be a human being, but that doesn't make you a person that gets protected. So whenever anybody brings this point up, which now comes up quite frequently, well, they're not a person. Here's my question to them, and it's a question that not only you should ask, but they must answer. And the question is, what's the difference? What's the difference between a human being and a human person? And the reason they must answer this is they have just essentially told you that humanity can be divided into two groups. One group gets the full protection of the law, human persons, and the rest you can annihilate without any justification whatsoever, human non-persons. You don't need to have a good reason to have an abortion. You can just have it. It's called elective abortion. It's called choice. So if there is a group of human beings that we can kill at will, we better know what distinguishes them from those that we can't. Where's that dividing line? And here, and I'm going to go very quickly here because I want to get to calls. There's a very handy little acronym, and I can't remember the fellow who thought this up, but I'm going to just give the nod to him. Good job. The acronym is SLED, S-L-E-D, and each letter stands for another characteristic of an unborn child that some people think legitimately disqualifies them from being valuable. Now, I am suspicious of all personhood language in debates like this because I think personhood is just a legal trick. It is a trick that allows us using language to disqualify certain members of the human family from being bona fide members of the human community. We say, yeah, they might be human beings, but they don't have this personhood thing, so we can just get rid of them. And that's nasty stuff because history is littered with the wreckage of that kind of thinking. But the SLED, I think, is a way of showing explicitly that this way of looking at it is not sound. Size or appearance, level of development or ability, that's the L, environment, E, or degree of dependency. Each one of these things are ways that people have tried to argue that the unborn human being is not a person and therefore is not worthy of protection. Size, they're just too small. But you notice when you say this that you are simply saying that size is what matters for human value. Well, they don't look like a human being. Of course they look like a human being. No, they don't. They look like every human being is supposed to look at that level of development, is my response. Human beings change over time. When you're little, you look one way, you're old, look another way, and in the middle, there's those three areas of your life, old, young, in the middle, you look at pictures of yourself, you can't tell it's the same individual, but it is, because you know it's you. Size, level of development, these things are inconsequential to human value. What a person can do. Does a handicapped person have less value than someone who doesn't have that handicap? No, size or level of development are irrelevant. What about environment, where one is at, like in the womb or out of the womb? This is another way people have argued. All right, look, if you're a valuable human being, yet the spot you're at now, do you lose your value when you walk across the street? When you roll over in bed? So how is it, if that doesn't happen with you, then how is it that baby somehow, you know, has this miraculous transformation through a 7-inch journey down the birth canal that transforms it from a non-valuable human being to a valuable human being we ought to protect? Location is trivial on this issue. What difference does it make? Which is why, by the way, Peter Singer, the ethicist at, is it Yale? Princeton. Is that right, Princeton? Thinks it should be okay to kill newborns. Because he agrees that the 7-inch journey down the birth canal is not relevant to the value. Location does not determine significance. Now, he's just reasoning logically. If you can kill the baby inside the womb and location is irrelevant, we should be able to kill the baby outside of the womb. By converse, if you can't kill the baby outside of the womb and that is not right, then moving the baby 7 inches over inside of the womb, the very same baby, by the way, how does that make it okay to kill that baby? Do you see how ludicrous that is? So environment has nothing to do with the value. And finally, size, level of development, environment, D, SLED, D, degree of dependency. Some people think, well, the baby's not viable at certain stages of development so that we can take that life. But why does dependency disqualify someone from their value? Aren't we more aware of the value of a human being the more dependent they are? It's just lunacy to me that you would think, okay, well, there's a nice, healthy, strapping individual. Here's another one that we got to, you know, like take care of. They can't survive on their own. Well, why does that mean we can execute them? So, by the way, no baby can survive on its own outside of the womb. I'm not sure if you realize that. If you're a mother or a dad, you know that. Some of you have teenagers that still can't survive on their own outside of the room. Some of you have husbands that still can't survive on their own outside of the womb. Neither size, nor level of development, nor environment, nor degree of dependency are adequate to disqualify any bona fide human being from their inherent, innate human value. This human being personhood, human person distinction is completely illegitimate. So the argument stands, it's still wrong to take the life of any valuable human, innocent human being without proper justification. Abortion does that because the reasons that people have abortions are not the reasons we would kill anybody else. Therefore, abortion is wrong. That is the logic of the pro-life position. If you want more details, you can find it at Making Abortion Unthinkable, The Art of Pro-Life Persuasion, available at Stand to Reason, or you can just go to our website and just type in abortion. You'll find lots of things there in that have been written and are free that will help you to work through the issue in a clear way.
That was Gregory Kukul from Stand to Reason with an excellent refutation of the pro-choice logic. And I want to just go over this for a few minutes because I know that sometimes when you listen to interviews, to discussions and soundbite, your mind has a tendency to wander. You're trying to understand this point, and then you kind of wander and think about how this you understand this. Let's go over this. Well, first of all, the Declaration of Independence, one of my most favorite phrases is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life is very important, of course, and the government has a responsibility to protect all valuable human life, and certainly not to kill it without justification. And as we listen to what Gregory unpacked there, the acronym SLED was very helpful. The pro-choice movement would say, well, the size is so small, so it's really not a human being, it's a fetus, it's a blob of tissue, but since when does size matter in determining the worth and the value of human beings? Well, this level of development, you know, does that make it less valuable? Think about the logic of the pro-choice movement. You are telling me that once that baby leaves the location of the mother's womb, it suddenly has become a human being? Really? When you look at ultrasound and you see the baby react pain of an abortion, of someone putting some instruments up to take him away, how that baby reacts on ultrasound, are you saying that this blob of tissue, this non-human who has no constitutional rights, doesn't feel pain? Don't human beings feel and react to pain? Are you serious? Then therefore, if that baby in the womb is a legitimate human being at this stage of development and location, then it is wrong to kill an innocent human being. When you think about all of this, you remember your history. You remember Adolf Hitler, what he tried to do to the, of course, to the Jewish race, the extinction and the murder of 6 million Jews, how when he began his crusade in Germany, that he decided that the mentally retarded people were unfit, they were a negative gene, and so he began to systematically have them murdered. So if you learn anything from history, this whole pro-choice agenda has its roots in history, which we should always remember. That kind of philosophy is demonic. I want you to understand something here. Hillary Clinton has an agenda, and her greatest avatar, if you will, the one that she esteems so much, is Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood. But if you remember your history, Planned Parenthood had a racist eugenics agenda. And what I want to do now for the next few minutes is I want you to hear about Planned Parenthood's racist agenda. Planned Parenthood is fully supported by Hillary Clinton. I want you to hear the history of this whole foundation. Let's listen.
Mm-hmm. you know, I know who Margaret Sanger is. And I know that she believed in eugenics and that she was not particularly enamored with black people. And one of the reasons that you find most of their clinics in black neighborhoods is so that you can find a way to control that population. And I think people should go back and read about Margaret Sanger, who founded this place, a woman who Hillary Clinton, by the way, says that she admires. Look and see what many people in Nazi Germany thought about her.
In 1916, H.G. Wells' lover, Margaret Sanger, starts her promotion of eugenics in the United States. In 1923, Sanger receives massive funding from the Rockefeller family. Sanger wrote to fellow eugenicist Clarence J. Gamble that black leaders would need to be recruited to act as front men in sterilization programs directed against black communities. In 1924, Hitler pens Mein Kampf, or My Struggle, and credits U.S. eugenicist as his inspiration.
I admire Margaret Sanger enormously, her courage, her tenacity, her vision. I am really in awe of her.
By 1927, eugenics hit the mainstream. The so-called science was aggressively pushed through contests at schools, churches, and at state fairs. Churches competed in contests with big cash prizes to see who could best implement eugenics into their sermons. Major denominations then tell Americans that Jesus is for eugenics. That same year in the United States, more than 25 states passed forced sterilization laws, and the Supreme Court ruled in favor of brutal sterilization policies. When Hitler came to power in 1933, one of his first acts was to pass national eugenics laws modeled after laws in the United States. The Nazi brand of eugenics had embarrassed the elites, but they had no intention of stopping their plans. The Allies literally fought with each other over who would get top Nazi eugenicist. It didn't matter if the SS doctors had tortured tens of thousands to death. They were free to go. The Angel of Death, Joseph Mengele, and his boss, Otmar von Werscher, were not prosecuted, and von Werscher even continued his work in Germany after the war. Eugenicists were angry that their great work had been exposed. They then scrambled to camouflage their agenda. Eugenics Quarterly became Social Biology. The American Birth Control League became Planned Parenthood. New terms like transhumanism, population control, sustainability, conservation, and environmentalism replaced racial hygiene and social Darwinism.
Mrs. Margaret Slee, president of America's Planned Parenthood Federation, maintains that European women should stop having babies for the next 10 years.
Don't you think such a theory, such a radical theory, is antisocial?
On the contrary, it seems to me that it is more practical and humane.
What about the women who want babies now and in 10 years will not be able to have babies? Rather impractical, don't you think?
Oh, John, you do ask hard questions. I should think that instead of being impractical, it is really very practical and intelligent and humane.
Well, there you have it. Exactly the person that Hillary Clinton esteems and follows after, that she models her thinking after, and none other than Margaret Sanger, who was a top proponent of eugenics, population control, forced sterilization, and, of course, a woman's right. And it comes right down to this kind of philosophy that our president would have. And you think about just what kind of climate we're living in. How did this all come about? How did we ever get to the point in our history with the devaluation of human life? How did it that our thinking and philosophy become so extreme that we can make these kinds of choices? The forced sterilization of black people was an agenda by the Planned Parenthood. Eugenics was an agenda by Planned Parenthood. It was a racist agenda that Hitler used in the extermination of Jews and of those that were mentally challenged that he thought was a defective gene in the upward scale of evolution. This kind of thinking comes as a result of our abandonment of the absolute truth. And when you abandon absolute truth, you are left with a society of we will choose what is right in the sight of our own eyes, and there is no absolute truth. I want us to take a couple of minutes to look at this issue because this is why we are at where we're at right now, because we have rejected the absolute truth that God intends us to live by. And I want you to hear in just a couple of minutes, Dr. Norman Geisler, who unpacked truth versus relativism. Let's listen.
Welcome to the 1 minute apologist. 1 minute apologist. If you had 1 minute apologia to be able to unpack for the audience,
we interview the world's leading apologists to provide credible answers to curious questions.
Welcome to the 1 minute apologist. My name is Bobby Conway, and I am here with Dr. Norman Geisler. Good to be with you, Dr. Geisler.
It's nice to be here, and it's nice to be anywhere at my age.
Hey, I think it's nice to be anywhere at my age as well. We're living in a time that is known as relativism, where people go around saying it doesn't matter what you believe and all beliefs are equal. We know that the ancient question that Jesus was asked by Pilate was, what is truth? How could you respond to somebody today who's a relativist by telling them what truth is?
Well, I'd say to them, truth is telling it like it is. That's a common everyday expression today. Truth is what corresponds to the facts. It's a fact that I'm here discussing this with you, so it's a true statement to say that I am. You know, it's a fact that I exist, so it's a true statement to say that I am. So there's nothing tricky about truth. It's what corresponds to the facts, what tells it like it is, what matches its object. If I say I'm sitting in a chair, matches the object, and falsehood is just the opposite. I'm not somewhere else. I'm right here today. You know, the square, the earth is not square. It's round. So truth is telling it like it is. Falsehood is the opposite of true, not telling it like it is. So there's nothing tricky about truth. What's tricky is that people think that you can apply this in a subjective way, and they say, well, it's true for you, but not for me. I say, well, it's not true for you. 2 plus 2 is true for both of us, you know. Yeah. And 3 times 3 is 9 is true for both of us. The law of non-contradiction is true for everybody. It's not just true somewhere. No matter what culture, what language you're in, it's still true. It's objectively true. If they say, well, I don't believe in objective truth, I say, is that objectively true? You know, or I don't believe in absolute truth, I say, is that absolutely true? You know, they're self-defeating statements. Well, I'm skeptical about everything. Well, you're skeptical about that? Are you really skeptical about everything? So everybody really in actual practice, in real life, everybody believes in absolute truth. You go into court and you say, I swear to tell the expedient, the whole expedient, and nothing but the expedient, so help me future experience. The judge won't buy it and the jury won't buy it.
And that is Dr. Norman Geisler unpacking just the absurdity of rejecting absolute truth. You really would have a problem in practical everyday life to say that I don't believe in absolute truth and then try to live what you just claimed. There is none better than William Lane Craig, who shows you and me the absurdity of when we say there are no absolutes, that everything is preference, and that it's true for you but not for me. He is going to show us how it's impossible to live by that claim. Let's listen right now.
I'm persuaded that although people give lip service to relativism, in fact, nobody can live that way. It is impossible to live with other persons regarding them as pure means to an end and not thinking that there are objectively right and wrong ways that you would want to treat them and that you would want them to treat you. Very often you can find out what a person really believes as opposed to what he says by how he reacts when people treat him in a certain way. For example, I had a friend who was a philosophy professor at a university, and a student in his philosophy class turned in a paper to him in which he argued for moral relativism, that there are no moral values, no moral duties, everything is relative and so forth. And my friend put an F on the paper and sent it back to the student, even though it was a good piece of work. And the student came into his office angry and said, "How can you give me this F? This was a good piece of research. How can you do that?" And the professor looked at him and he said, it was handed in a blue folder. And I don't like blue folders. The grade is an F." And the student said, "But that's not fair. You can't do that." And the professor said, "It's not what? Isn't this the paper that argued that there is no such thing as fairness and moral rightness and wrongness?" And all of a sudden, the student got the point. And at that point, the professor changed the grade to an A and turned it back into the student. I think the student learned more through that experience than he did through writing the paper. See, it's how we react when others treat us in ways that we think are wrong that our real moral sensitivities come out. So I would try to talk with a person who claims that there is no objective moral values, no moral duties, just about his life, about how he lives his life, how he reacts if, say, the church were to institute the Inquisition in this country and begin to execute people, if he thinks that wouldn't be a wrong thing to do. And I find that with 98% of people who are sincere and not just wanting to argue, 98% of people can be very quickly brought to the point that they do see that there are really objective moral values and duties. And then that really faces them with a crisis because they've got to decide if these really are objective, where do they come from? What's the foundation for them? And I think this really does provide powerful reason to believe in a transcendent good that is the source of these values and duties.
Well, and William Lane Craig's illustration is perfect for the relativist. To those that don't believe in absolute truth, that everything's opinion, you can't live that way. Because the moment you try to do so, and you're like the person that hands the paper into his professor, the professor is going to take your arguments and turn it right on you, and suddenly you begin to realize, hey, I can't live by what I believe and think, because this is a world. It is a moral universe that was created by a moral God with objective moral standards that we need to live by. And you can't exist and live without adhering to those standards because it becomes very quickly a brick wall that you run into. Well, I want to come back and summarize everything that we've been saying this morning on the Cross in the Desert about Hillary Clinton, the pro-choice movement, and how we have come to this place in history because we've rejected absolutes and moral values. I'll come back and we'll summarize this, but right now I want you to hear a beautiful song by an outstanding musician about the right to choose and about the right to be a person in a world that is free from this kind of thinking. He's writing about the unborn and their value as human life. And I want you to hear Phil Kagi right now with a beautiful song in tribute to the beautiful unborn children that have been slaughtered. Let's listen.
Their precious lives are on the line. turn about and face the young defendants who speak up for the little ones, helpless and half abandoned. They've got a right to choose life they don't want to lose. I've got to speak up, won't you? Many come and many go, conceive but not deliver. The toll is astronomical. Oh, how can we be indifferent? Little hands, little feet, tears for him who made you. Should all on earth forsake you now, yet he'll never forsake you. Who will speak up for the little ones, helpless and half abandoned? They've got a right to choose life they don't want to lose. I've got to speak up, won't you?
Tribute to the Unborn by Phil Kagi, who suffered many, many miscarriages together with his wife. And he actually wrote this song. He was in the hospital. His wife actually this time was successful in giving birth, and God had blessed them. And he wrote this song in tribute to the precious, valuable life of the many unborn children who weren't fortunate to be born through personal, evil, selfish choices that abortionists make. And today on the Cross in the Desert, we have outlined the position of Hillary Clinton. We have outlined the atmosphere and the culture and how we have come as a culture to this point that we look at the unborn as nothing more than a blob of tissue we can just do with what we want. How we've come to that as a society and a culture by abandoning absolute truth and throwing away God's standard and saying we will do what we choose to do under the right of choice. And as my guests Rick and Cindy Morgan so eloquently pointed out on Monday, quoting from the book of Judges, that there was a time when everyone did what was right in the sight of their own eyes. And we have descended once again into that kind of thinking and to that kind of culture. The only way I know how to summarize everything I've talked to you about this morning is to go to the authority of Scripture. And Rick and Cindy talked about this verse on Monday, and I want to go back to it because I want this verse to get in our thinking as what God says about the preciousness of human life in the mother's womb and how that person is a person that has constitutional rights, unlike what Hillary Clinton says about the unborn. We need to go to the authority of God's word and hear what God says about the beauty of the unborn. Psalm 139 is a wonderful psalm that extols the mighty presence of God, his omnipresence, that he is everywhere present at the same time, and how he's all-knowing, he's omniscient, he knows every thought and intent of our heart. I want you to hear the beauty of this psalm and how it so supports the life and the preciousness of the unborn. David writes, O Lord, you have examined my heart and you know everything about me. You know when I sit down or stand up. You know my thoughts even when I'm far away. You see me when I travel and when I rest at home. You know everything I do. You know what I'm going to say even before I say it, Lord. You go before me and follow me. You place your hand of blessing on my head. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too great for me to understand. I can never escape from your spirit. I can never get away from your presence. If I go up to heaven, you are there. If I go down to the grave, you are there. If I ride the wings of the morning, if I dwell by the farthest oceans, even there, your hand will guide me and your strength will support me. I could ask the darkness to hide me and the light around me to become night, but even in darkness, I cannot hide from you. To you the night shines as bright as the day. Darkness and light are the same to you. Verse 13. You made all the delicate inward parts of my body and knit me together in my mother's womb. Thank you for making me so wonderfully complex. Your workmanship is marvelous. How well I know it. You watched me as I was being formed in utter seclusion, as I was woven together in the dark of the womb. You saw me before I was born. Every day of my life was recorded in your book. Every moment was laid out before a single day had passed. How precious are your thoughts about me, O God. They cannot even be numbered. David so eloquently recalls the time that he was in his mother's womb. For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made, the English Standard Version says. Here we have what I think is explicit biblical evidence, personhood of every human being. And you think about what I've shared with you today on size and location and all of the things that the pro-choice people try to use to say that that being in the mother's womb is not very valuable, that is, until it emerges. How did we descend into such gross and illogical thinking? We descended because we abandoned God's truth. We said no to his absolutes. We declared that what we believe about life has far more significance than what God has already said. And once we as a culture descend into that kind of thinking, when we abandon the truth claims of Scripture and what God has said, then we're no different than Hitler and every other maniac and every other dictator and every other person on the earth that says, I will do what is right in the sight of mine own eyes. That's how we've come to where we're at. And the only way back is recognizing that what I just read is what God just said, and what God says matters infinitely more than what we think or say, because God is the one who created us. God is the one that shaped our inward parts in our mother's womb. God declares that this is a person and not a tissue, and not a blob that we can, at our convenience, do with what we will. When we declare something to not be human, to not be life, and to take matters in our own hands, we have created God in our own image, and we've become our own little gods. And God says in his word that the little gods who think they have made the heavens and the earth will perish. And so today what we've been doing on the cross in the desert is opening up the scriptures and letting the breath of God's truth shine in our hearts. It's not difficult. It's not complicated. This is what truth and reality is. And the only way back from where we've come to and where we've descended to is a return to God. It is a repentance. It is an acknowledgement that what he says is truth, opposed to any other claim of truth. And that's what I believe it will take for our nation to shine again, for our government to shine again, is for our government, our nation, to return to the Lord God of heaven, to return to Jesus, to return to his truth, and his truth is the only truth. I want to thank you so much, everyone, today. Patricia, for Rick, for everyone in the chat room, thank you so much. God bless you for joining me today on the Cross in the Desert. I will see you very soon again on Monday. God bless you. Have a great weekend.
Oh, glory, glory.